This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
When you took the dog for a walk this morning, if you'd come across a kangaroo, what do you think may have happened? Would your dog bark? Would it run at it? Would it want to play with the kangaroo? Would you be able to control your dog? And was your dog on a leash? And have you seen a kangaroo when walking your dog? And do we now need to be educated on what to do and how to train our dogs? 1300 222 774. And also this half hour, the Wuthering Heights reviews are out. And they're not good. 2 stars. But are you going to see it this opening weekend for the storyline?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So as kangaroos are pushed into more urban areas as they search for water or green space, and now because we build homes and roads in areas where they live, we're going to see more kangaroos in and around our homes. But do you know how they behave? Do you know what to do and how to react when you see one? And do you know what to do if you have your dog with you? Do you know how to control your dog around a kangaroo? Just recently, a man trying to rescue his dog from a kangaroo ended up in a really terrible way. So as a result, it started a conversation around just how much we know about how kangaroos behave and how your dog behaves around kangaroos. Mike Fury is a paramedic and a spokesperson for the Victorian Kangaroo Alliance. Mike, as people are out walking their dogs this morning, as they're maybe doing it now and listening to this, as they do it after work, if they come across a kangaroo, do you think the average dog owner knows what to do?
Good morning, Rochelle. Look, I think probably not. I think kangaroos are so infrequently seen that people tend to not think about what happens in the case of an unintended conflict and what behaviour should I be looking out for and what actions do I need to take to stay safe for myself, keep my animals, my companion animals safe, and also not to distress the kangaroo too much.
There's already a text that's come in that says, Rish, Matthew here, this is such a coincidence that you're talking about this morning. I'm working from home and a large male kangaroo had pinned my dog to the ground. Even my boss heard the dog screaming. I had to run out of the meeting and up to the scene. The roo wasn't intimidated of me running up to it. My grass is green compared to the property around it. It must be resource related. This is not the first time I've heard the terminology used, the kangaroo pinning my dog to the ground. Are kangaroos pinning dogs down?
Well, not without provocation, I'd say. If the grass was green, it was a food source, and if the kangaroo had gone to ingest some of that grass, then and the dog came out and thought, oh, an intruder, and then went barking after the kangaroo, then the kangaroo would have seen that as a threat.
Mm.
And probably that was the reason behind, it pinning the dog down. So,
and this is, I mean, there's, a couple of issues here. There's one, walking your dog through an area that isn't your own property where you may see a kangaroo and how you react. And then there's a kangaroo coming onto your property if grass is a resource or if you live in a semi-rural or regional areas. These are very different. I'm just wondering, in your time as a paramedic, either dogs being injured, owners being injured, trying to help their dogs. Is this a big issue?
Not really. It's infrequent, and I'd suggest that it's probably less than shark encounters with sharks by far. The last encounter that we had where I live in a regional town was something in the vicinity of 5-6 years ago, and it was a woman walking her dog along a fire trail. The dog was off leash and they just happened to stumble across a kangaroo that was grazing on the the grass side of the fire trail, and they all got a fright, you know, because they didn't expect that encounter. And the dog went onto the offensive mode and started barking and getting up close to the kangaroo. The woman acted instinctively, I must get my dog away from the kangaroo. The kangaroo saw that as a bigger threat. And so the escalation occurred and she got injured. Fortunately, she escaped with only, you know, deep lacerations, scratching and bruising, just soft tissue stuff. Yeah, yeah, it was still traumatic from that point of view of that encounter up close. It was just sad and unavoidable. Sorry, and avoidable, I should say. With some awareness.
Gosh, that's frightening, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, there's knowing how our dogs will react, but then there's also, as humans, knowing how you would react. I remember going for a walk very early in the morning around a golf course. I didn't have my phone with me or anything. We were just having a little weekend away, and a couple of really large kangaroos all of a sudden were in front of me, and I just stood still like a statue, and I was so panicked. I'd never actually been that close, and all of a sudden I thought, holy moly, I'm not actually sure what I should be doing here. Mike, stay with us. Mike Fury, paramedic and spokesperson for the Victorian Kangaroo Alliance, is with you. So I want to have a chat to Rosie, who's in Daylesford. You get a lot of kangaroos around there, Rosie.
We do indeed. And the ever-increasing developments around here worry me. It leaves less and less and less territory for wildlife. Which we really have to share. But I have a Jack Russell who I got when she was five and from the pound. And she was walking with a few Kelpies, my nieces and nephews, in the Wombat Forest one day. And I thought I'd keep her on the lead because she's unpredictable. I didn't know what she would do. So they were off lead. And eventually I thought, no, bugger that. I'll let her off, poor old thing. So I did, and she walked with us very obediently for about 15 minutes, and then she got the whiff of a kangaroo, and she was off. And we shouted and called and searched, and no sign of her. And we headed up the tracks in four-wheel drives, couldn't find her. And then after about 2 hours of searching, we headed back to the car, and it was getting dark. There she was at the car, looking at her watch, saying,
thinking, where the hell are you been?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, Jack Russells are little. They can run fast, but they're little dogs too. So the last thing you want is having them up against a kangaroo. Has anything happened since, Rosie?
Nothing. Well, since then she's got old, and she's now incredibly old. So a different personality altogether.
Oh, but thank goodness. That would be a fright for you.
I won't be letting her off the lead again. The other thing she did when she was on the lead, again, as an extending lead, is caught a copperhead. And I was on one end and she was on the other with a copperhead snake. She's quite an adventurous girl.
Well, I'm glad she's okay. What's your dog's name?
She's named Archie, she's named after a very famous, the most famous in the world, of course, the Irish horses are, a most famous racehorse, steeplechaser, Archie.
Oh, beautiful. Oh, Rosie, thank you. Just finally, Mike, so I want to have a chat to you and Richie, who's a regular on this program and a wildlife ecologist from Deakin, just about how we behave, how humans behave around kangaroos and vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, Rosie's obviously in Daylesford, you would expect kangaroos, but then Andrew sent this and says, good morning, I regularly run around Westerfolds Park in Templestowe. This is a home to a large mob of kangaroos, but it's also a dog on leash park. However, on occasion I've witnessed dog owners release their dogs from the lead, seemingly for the purpose of chasing kangaroos. This is distressing to watch. There's been no injuries to kangaroos or to dog owners, but they need to behave responsibly in public spaces. Yeah. This is a broad sentiment, so it's a bit of a tricky one to answer, but generally, are humans behaving with the respect that is needed when it comes to kangaroos, not only for their well-being, but just for their sheer strength and force and intelligence?
Yeah, I think there's people probably There's a cohort of people that are, and then there's people who probably are ignorant, and those who want to up the ante a little bit and, you know, release a dog from the leash in an area that's known to have wildlife, to, you know, provoke and harass the animal. So, yeah, I think people largely are responsible, but respecting them means understanding their behaviour and knowing how to extract oneself from potential conflict situations.
Mike, thank you. Mike Fury, a paramedic and spokesperson for the Victorian Kangaroo Alliance. And this story was brought to us off the back of a man who was, he was injured from a kangaroo, so was his dog. And some of the reports were talking about the fact that, and making statements around the fact that the kangaroo was trying to drown his dog. And since then, I've received multiple texts this morning saying you'll find that a kangaroo will try to lure a dog to water and then pin it down and tie and drown the dog. Before we have a chat to Sarah in the Macedon Ranges, whose dog had an encounter with a kangaroo, I actually want to put that to Ewan Ritchie, a wildlife ecologist at Deakin University. Ewan, are kangaroos luring dogs to waterways to drown them?
Morning, Rochelle. They're not luring them there, but they are absolutely defending themselves using that technique.
Wow.
It's well known, and it probably evolved to deal with dingoes, which have obviously been on the Australian continent, the mainland, for probably 3,500 to 4,000 years. So, you know, kangaroos have had to deal with dingoes, which obviously are superficially like dogs, for a long time. And they are absolutely capable of drowning dogs, and they do. And
I think
this is the recipe for disaster, that when people are walking their dogs in areas where there might be kangaroos, also wallabies, but particularly kangaroos. Kangaroos are big, powerful animals. An eastern grey kangaroo male can be over 70 kilos.
Yeah.
A red kangaroo male could be 90 kilos.
Whoa.
And they can stand well above 6 foot when they're on the tippy toes. And so basically what happens is, you know, the dog runs out chasing the kangaroo into the water. The kangaroo will often crouch down first. When the dog swims out, they then stand up and push them under the water and hold them under the water.
Sarah,
with their long, powerful arms. So people just need to be really aware of this.
Sarah's in the Macedon Ranges. Sarah, is that what happened to you?
Yes, yes, exactly that. I was running with my dog, and he's a little Jack Russell, and he came across a kangaroo who stood up and made himself as huge as possible. And after, you know, 5 minutes of a bark off, and I was too scared to go near them, the kangaroo jumped away and went to a dam. And I only found out later on that what the plan was to drown my dog.
I had no idea. Wow. Yeah. So, Sarah, since then, now what do you do? I mean, you would have been running with your dog off leash, so maybe on leash?
Yeah. So I used to always have him on leash to a certain point where I knew there was no kangaroos. But now he's old now, so he doesn't really do the run anymore. But, yeah, it always on lead.
Sarah, thank you. I'm glad you and your dog's okay. Dr. Ewan Ritchie, I mean, kangaroos are there. They're a part of our landscape. Where we are and where they are is changing. I'm just wondering how much we can live side by side. You know, like when you think about snakes, for example, and what to do and how to act and react. Kangaroos, is it that we just shouldn't be in some areas?
Look, we absolutely can live alongside kangaroos, and it's a privilege and a wonderful thing that we have native wildlife in and around our cities. So we simply just need to do really simple things that can keep our pets safe, can keep us safe, and also kangaroos safe. And that means that if you're in an area where you think there might be kangaroos, but also other wildlife, just don't let your dog run off leash. And go to an area where there is a designated off-leash area that is probably likely to be largely free of wildlife, and that means that both your dog, you, and the wildlife are safer. And it's really important to remember that, you know, even when the kangaroos might sometimes escape from being chased by a dog, they might hit a fence and hurt themselves. They might run into a car, causing another accident somewhere else. So there's a whole range of really bad outcomes that can occur if we have dogs chasing kangaroos.
Gosh, and given how dry it is, you just know in your own gardens, and there's a text here from Alan. This is terrible. It says, it's so dry. I got the train from Seymour to Melbourne yesterday. I only saw two kangaroos out the train window and one of them was dead, and I usually see dozens. And so I could imagine, Ewan, given how dry some areas are at the moment, that we are going to see kangaroos in places we may not have in the past.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, they will be doing it absolutely really tough in some areas. And, of course, we've had fires too that have removed a lot of vegetation in some parts of Victoria. So there will be kangaroos looking for food, and that means they're more likely to pop up in someone's backyard or on the side of the road where you get runoff and therefore more, you know, green grass. And so, again, it's just a matter of being really careful, you know, driving slowly, but also in areas where you might be walking your dog, have them on a lead. You know, it's just not worth the risk to yourself, to your dog, and also to kangaroos and other wildlife to have those, you know, potentially really bad things happening.
John's in Camberwell. Morning.
Morning. I have my old dog, Bluey, a golden retriever, down at Aries Inlet. He spent a lot of his time at Aries, and we were on the river one day, and he was a roo popped along behind us, about 4 metres behind us, and Bluey chased him. The roo went into the river and Blue chased him straight in, and they were face to face in the middle of the river. And the kangaroo popped up and pushed Bluey underwater, got his claws and pushed him underwater. We could only see the roo for a little while. And then Blue popped up and I screamed at him and he turned around and swam back. But I definitely tried to drown him in the river.
Wow. That's like a fierce Australiana image that, you know, you just wouldn't think was even vaguely possible. And that he was okay. Your dog was okay, John. Bluey was okay.
He was fine. Yeah, Bluey loved it. He did a great game.
Far out.
Photo of them face to face. I'll try and dig it up and send it into you in the middle of a river.
Oh, Ewan, do we need to educate ourselves more on this? Do there need to be more science around of kangaroos, and especially for dog walkers? We have it with bird life on some beaches. Where are we at when it comes to just our education and sense of safety?
Look, I think we can never have enough education about these things because we don't want these events occurring. Although, you know, that dog got away in that case, many dogs don't. And of course, the unfortunate man who got severely injured just recently trying to help his dog. So we just don't want these things occurring, and they don't have to occur. So I think the more public education we can have about how dogs interact with wildlife and what responsible pet ownership looks like in areas where there are large wildlife or, you know, wildlife that's potentially dangerous, I think the better.
Let's have a chat to Alison in Croydon. Good morning.
Hi, Rochelle. I had an encounter with a full-grown male kangaroo in Croydon, of all places.
Mm. It was pretty leafy. It's pretty hilly.
Yeah, but it's still pretty suburban and we don't usually see things, but it had followed the rail line. It was during a drought period. It was last time we had a drought a few years ago, and it obviously followed the rail road down. And I had a greyhound cross Rhodesian Ridgeback who was dumped in a rescue dog, but they had been bred for hunting kangaroos and dumped because they couldn't sell them. But I'm a dog obedience instructor, so my dog was highly trained. I told him to stop, told him to come back. I put him on the lead and then we backed away. What I haven't heard is like instructions about what you should do. It's the same.
Yes, that's my next question. What should you do?
Is back away. Back away, give them space. As soon as it is a threat. It is a threat thing. They don't go after people unless they feel threatened. Same with dogs, aggressive dogs and stuff. You should back away. Back away, back away, give them space. And what I did was because I knew when there was, it was the dog obedience dog park, and it's a lot of people have their dogs off lead. So we circled well around the roo, called, was it the Animal Wildlife Rescue Wise? We called them to come and get it because there was no way it was going to find its way back to where it should be in suburbia. And we just, I just warned everybody else to leave the park and back away, and we just stayed there until the wildlife people got. But yeah, space. People, give them space, back away very slowly, and if you can, call your dog back, put it straight on the lead, and back away. They just want space. It's about threat.
Yeah, that's really good advice, Alison. Thank you. Just finally, you and Richie, is that the same advice for humans? Even if you are Sans dog, is it standing still, backing away?
couldn't agree more with what was just said. You know, basically, a kangaroo is not going to attack you unless it's provoked or unless it feels at risk itself. So if you give it plenty of room, it'll hop away. It just needs to know that it basically has an out. And obviously, when they're being chased by a dog in particular, they get particularly stressed. So if you give them plenty of room and don't approach them, there's really nothing to worry about. So it's really just being sensible about that. And that of course, applies not just to kangaroos, but pretty much all wildlife. It's same as snakes, of course. Most people that get bitten by snakes are trying to do something really stupid to the snake. If you see a snake and you stand completely still or you back away if it's safe to do so, there's no risk to you at all. So really, it's just about being sensible and respecting native wildlife.
Just finally, Ewan, we've seen kangaroos in more urban and built-up areas now, but in what looked like a sort of weird twisted commercial for Qantas just the other week, we saw a kangaroo jumping through the water, the shallows of Aspendale Beach down at Edith Vale or Aspendale. How rare is it for a kangaroo to be jumping through the shallows of the bay?
Look, they're quite good swimmers, people might not realise, and it's not uncommon for kangaroos, in fact, a lot of wildlife, to go into salt water. Echidnas do it as well, and swim across bays and so forth. We think in some cases kangaroos might actually go into salt water to get rid of parasites that are on their fur, so things like ticks and so forth. So it's not uncommon for kangaroos to bounce through the water, but even go a bit deeper if they're trying to get from one place to another.
Ewan, always good to get your insights. Very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Rochelle. Pleasure.
Ewan Ritchie, wildlife ecologist at Deakin University. Stay still, back away. Make sure your dog is on a leash, in particular in areas where you know there are kangaroos. We'll try and get back to more of your calls and texts on this a little later in the program. Well, the reviews are out for Wuthering Heights. Maybe you're going to see it this weekend. The reviews aren't great, but does that matter?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, the world, and let's be honest, women mainly, have gone gaga for Wuthering Heights, and it's not even out yet. The thing is, we all know the storyline. We all know how it ends. Most of us read it at school. It was a school text. So that might be part of the reason why that we're going to see it. But the thing is, the reviews are out and it's not great. But I have the feeling that we're still going to go and see it anyhow. And why? Well, because it's a little bit sexy. It's a little bit saucy. It's rated R. And is it just the next 50 Shades of Grey? Is that the reason why so many people, in particular women, are going? Are you going this weekend? And are you going for the storyline because you just love Wuthering Heights? Or are you going for the romanticy? Trina Orchard is an anthropologist and associate professor at the School of Health Studies at Western University in Canada. Trina, most of us, we know the story of Wuthering Heights. We read it at school. So the fact that it's getting kind of only 2 stars in some of the reviews that have come out locally here, I don't think that's going to stop many people going this weekend because they're going for the romanticy, I would say. Do you agree?
I would say so. I think that we look at the two main characters. I mean, they're both, obscenely beautiful people. And I think that we have been hearing that the chemistry between them is very, very authentic and kind of spicy. So that sort of ramps up the curiosity. And I mean, we have to also remember that this movie has been, this book has been remade into about 30 or 35 different adaptations. And I think sometimes we go to these kind of classic movies also just to see what's the unique spin going to be on it this time.
I remember when 50 Shades first came out and just the hype around it, who was seeing it, and the conversations around, why women in particular were so drawn to this. And romanticy as a genre now, it's one of the fastest selling book genres. And the theory around, is it just porn for women because women want that same kind of sauciness and sex on screen, but they want the storyline behind it?
Yeah, I think one thing about 50 Shades, and perhaps with this new film that I have not seen, is that it's not just for the romanticity. I think it's the underlying taboo that's associated with kink and with certain kinds of sexuality that we don't see that much, but that a lot of people clearly think about at different points in their intimate lives. So I think that is also part of the draw as well.
Do you think couples will go and see it? It's being released on Valentine's Day, you know, and there's already a little bit of cancel culture around Valentine's Day anyhow, but it's obviously deliberately being released on that day. From what I can gather, and anecdotally, it's girlfriends going to watch it together.
Yeah, I kind of gather that as well. And also a lot of young women in particular, female identifying folks, are kind of reclaiming Valentine's Day for themselves, Galentine's, right? And sort of doing sort of communal things, different kinds of activities that don't center around like a romantic partner necessarily. But it remains to be seen whether or not couples will go. I think it depends on the couple and the kind of relationship that it, you know, it could be, you know, just the first part of their romantic day together.
Trina, do you see any slowing down in the romanticy genre, whether it be books or screen?
Absolutely not. It is a genre that is growing. There's so many different kinds of shades of love, intimacy, longing, yearning, you know, the popularity of, for instance, Heated Rivalry, you know, that romance novel, right?
It's women, a lot of straight women watching Heated Rivalry.
Along with other people, you know, people seem so amazed that straight women want to watch this thing. But yeah, they are one of the primary viewers. And that makes sense in terms of the romance genre sort of writ large. Mm. But I think another really important reason why romanticy is only going to be growing is because of the fact that in precarious times, romance ramps up. We need a light in the darkness, and that is a huge factor that really supports the growing industry in this genre.
Yeah, I just don't think that the bad reviews so far will stop it in any way. It's had an incredible run-up. The marketing team behind it, the costumes in the marketing team behind it, it's been quite bizarre to watch that unfold, even how they're dressing Margot Robbie and where they're getting, you know, the necklaces from and her press outfits. I'm trying to think of a press junket and tour leading up to it that I've seen anything like it.
Especially for a classic novel, you know, as opposed to sort of a brand new kind of film, or think of like Sinners, for instance. That is a very sexy film that is getting so many accolades. I believe it's the most nominated film in terms of number of Oscars it's been nominated for ever. So, I mean, the sex in that movie is also very juicy and really interesting, but there's so much other stuff going on with the story as well. But sex will always sell.
You just have to think about who you take to see it. I remember a girlfriend saying that she took her mother-in-law to see 50 Shades, and halfway through the film she was like, this is not going well. What on earth have I done? Trina, thank you. Wonderful to get your insights.
You never know. Yes, I was just going to say that you never know. The mother-in-law might have actually really enjoyed herself.
Exactly. She probably did. Thanks, Trina. Yeah. Trina Orchard, who's an anthropologist and associate professor in the School of Health Studies at Western University. There you go. It is rated M here in Australia. I did check, actually. Maybe the press release that I got sent to me was the American press release, because it was certainly rated R, the one that I got sent. So there's different ratings here. What does that say about us? Who knows? When you look around your home at the moment, if you're in the lounge room, if you're in the bedroom, do you have any pieces of furniture that you would want to pass down to your kids? You know, would it stand the test of time? Is it beautiful? Is it handmade? But, you know, how cheap and cheerful was your bedside table? How often do you buy a new coffee table? So fast furniture, right? Cheap furniture we can whack together ourselves. It's everywhere now. And it's not only an issue for the environment, but that sort of cheap flat pack furniture is potentially killing the antiques trade. It turns out, according to some, We don't want antiques anymore. We don't want that large mahogany sideboard. And there's this theory that they're just too expensive. And as a result, we just don't have the antiques store and we don't have that love of antiques. Do you have antique furniture in your home? Do you have a piece of furniture that has been handed down to you in your family? And do you have anything in your home that you think will stand the test of time? Trevor Hancock is a board member for the Australian Antique and Art Dealers Association. Trevor, have we lost our love of antiques?
No, we haven't. And how appropriate that we should be talking about antiques after the last interview, I must say. because antiques are sexy.
Yes, I think they are.
Yes. I mean, I'm sitting in a chair that's 200 years old. It was handmade, and it's the most comfortable thing you've ever sat in. And in addition to that, there is a really growing interest in antiques, despite what some people might say. Not only, 200-year-old things, but pieces might be 50, 60, 80 years old.
The antique store, to go and walk through an antique store, to be able to touch beautiful handmade furniture, even the smell of an antique store. I'm trying to think now, and there used to almost be an antique store, not every high street, but, maybe every second or third high street. Are we now wheeling and dealing in antiques through bricks and mortar stores, or is it all being done online?
It's a bit of both. Some are old enough to remember High Street Armadale, which I think must have had about 100 antique stores in it. In many respects, a lot of those people dealing with antiques then were there to make money only. And the true antique dealer never retires. They just spend their life researching, tracking down antiques and finding things for their clients and unusual things. That's still happening now, I can assure you.
When does something become antique? So there's lots of labelling to certain pieces of furniture that we will just give it ourselves, retro or vintage or mid-century. I'm just wondering at what point does mid-century become an antique or does vintage become antique?
I think it's very much, a point of view. I was just looking at Melbourne suburban auction house site just a moment ago, and you may not be old enough to remember in the 60s they had wonderful chrome top and vinyl top kitchen tables.
Oh, yeah.
And those sort of things. Well, there was a set there that I guess has never been used, and the estimate was $100 to $200.
Wow.
So, there's really a stylish piece of furniture that could be used immediately, almost a giveaway price. And I can guarantee it'll bring a lot of comments if you had something like that in your home. The other thing that Victoria's probably lucky because particularly for antiques displayed and that. The Antique Dealers Association have their annual fair at the end of April at the Malvern Town Hall. That's where you'll see the best antiques in Australia. And there's also there's an opportunity to see interesting things if you join the National Trust. But we're lucky enough in Victoria to have probably the best antique centre in Australia, I think, and that's in Bendigo. So if you want a really pleasant outing, go to Bendigo and have a look at that.
Yeah, that's why their op shops are so good in Bendigo as well. And their hard rubbish in Bendigo, very, very, very good. We know fast fashion and we know the problems that that's causing to landfill. But if you drive down any suburban street now, guaranteed there'll be some kind of fast furniture out on the curb. The days of holding on to furniture for long periods of time to the point where you even pass it down to a family member, is that being lost just because you can get a new coffee table from IKEA or Kmart for, sometimes as cheap as $50?
Yeah, it's a shame, really, because I find with my grandchildren, other grandchildren, they're really interested in family history. And if you spend some time with them and explain how this chair or this table was made, or even a piece of jewellery, how that was made, where the gemstones came from, they really have an interest in it. And particularly if it's a family piece, you can explain that it was your great-grandmother's and she used to sit there and make clothes. And that there's something very touching and human and warm when there's that connection.
And the idea of something that's handmade as well, and when you can see the time and the effort and the skill that's gone into it. Trevor Hancock is with you, board member for the Australian Antique and Art Dealers Association. Peter's out and about and on the road. Morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
I've got my radio from my dad. When I was a little boy, I remember it in the shed up the back. He used to listen to this valve radio in a cabinet. The shed actually burnt down, but the radio survived.
Oh, wow.
And I kept it, and I kept it, and I kept it, and it was looking horrible. So I actually found someone who can restore an old Rembrandt valve radio, and I've given it, had it restored, cost me a little bit of money, don't care, but it's now with my son, who has got it with all the information about my dad and how long he had it and all that, and he's going to hand it down to my grandson.
Valve radio sounds so special, Peter.
Yes, it works. He just plugs it in and he can listen to it in his garage where he's got it now. And I love it. It's such a nice feeling to know that it's gone right through the family and he's got a son now that he's going to give it to.
Oh, lovely. This is thank you, Peter. This is an interesting angle to whether or not we are wanting antiques or buying antiques or holding on to them. And it's just how we live and the types of homes that we live in now. We talk more and more in this city about having to go to medium to high density in an apartment living, townhouses. And this message says, I would love to have antiques. There's an amazing carved and extendable table that I'd love to inherit from my parents one day, but I can't afford the type of house that tends to go with it. Thanks to baby boomers who haven't downsized and have all of their wealth. Okay, there's a little dig at baby boomers at the end there. That's a whole other conversation. But the idea of antiques being bigger, being more cumbersome, not being able to fit into apartments. Is that true, Trevor?
Oh, look, it is true. You know, a 12-seater dining room table is not going to fit in a one-bedroom apartment down in South Bank. But there are some really lovely, interesting, smaller pieces of furniture that you could pick up fairly inexpensively, or you can go to the other end and go and buy a really magnificent piece of furniture. And I can guarantee when your guests arrive, that will cause great comment and admiration. It's the as you said, the modern stuff which is churned out doesn't last, and everybody has it.
And then that's right, and it doesn't last that long. And then because if it's based on fashion as well, all of a sudden you're going to update it in a year or two's time, and as a result, that's why it all ends up out on the curb as well. That's part of the reason. And it's interesting. There's a text here that's come through talking about pianos and how sometimes now we just see even pianos smashed up on the side of the road because we don't have the homes where pianos will fit anymore, and that they're just dying out.
Yes, of course, part of the problem is they're so darn heavy, especially steel-framed ones. But you will still see really good quality pianos will still bring a significant amount of money, Steinways and these sort of pieces. But, of course, you've got to have the home for it. But for those just in a small apartment, just consider something special, small and unique. It's not only the piece of furniture, but you might find a really interesting piece of porcelain to go on top of it.
It's making me want to go hard rubbish hunting now. You just got to find all the good suburbs.
Well, I mean, it's in the same league as the opportunity shops.
Yeah.
You know, don't go past an opportunity shop.
Oh, never do.
Have a look.
Never do, Trevor. Don't you worry about that. Trevor Hancock, board member for the Australian Antique and Art Dealers Association. Thank you for your time. If you are an antiques dealer, and if you have been in the past, are people coming in and are younger people coming in as well? And if you live in an apartment, do you have antiques? 1-300-222-774. You can text as well. 0437-774-774. Rish, I have a footstool that my father-in-law had made, and my mother-in-law made a tapestry for me that has sentimental value and should remain in the family. That's from Judy.
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Oh, this is interesting. I have several antique pieces of my mother's in my apartment, and it actually mixes well with my modern pieces too. So there you go. If you've just joined us, we were talking about the fact that Wuthering Heights was released to media yesterday. It's not getting great reviews, but will that stop you going on the weekend? Kate's in South Gippsland. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Well, I was the organiser of Gippsland's most Wuthering Heights ever, just after COVID.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah. And what I experienced sort of organising an event like that, because I'd been to the Melbourne one years ago, was that we didn't just get Kate Bush fans turning up in the red dresses, but we also got a lot of people who loved the story of Wuthering Heights and wanted to be involved with it. And I think what we realised is when you're teaching the choreography to the Wuthering Heights dance, the moves are actually quite, there's like, it's sort of like it sort of sends it up a little bit, sends up the melodrama. So it was something that was really interesting to just have a bit of a laugh while we were doing it. So I think everyone's going to go and see the film, but just not take it too seriously.
I'm sensing that this is something like audience participation, dress up. Are you dressing up, Kate, to go and see it?
Yeah. Oh, to dress up to it?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Oh, come on. Why not?
Look, you might get people. That's a great idea. I reckon we should put it out on the Wuthering Heights.
100%. You know, Rocky Horror-esque. Participation, dancing in the aisles. Do you care, Kate, that it's been getting bad reviews? Will you go and see it anyway?
No, look, I love, it's Emerald Ferrell, isn't it? I love her films. I love that she actually has that, like, really, it's sometimes cringeworthy, but you just can't take your eyes away from it, you know, and it could be a full-on sex scene or just, like, a really interesting relationship and people, like, not behaving really. Like, they're real dark horses, all her characters. So, I mean, what a perfect story for her to do. So I'm definitely seeing it.
Okay, thank you. Oh, I love it. There you go. I reckon I'm sensing dress-ups for sure. Some lovely messages coming in about antiques and whether or not you still buy them, whether you hold on to them, if they've been passed down to you. I have my great-grandmother's grandfather clock as well as my grandmother's a pianola that I play. And this morning I have furniture from my great-grandmother, my piano from her and other pieces from my grandmother, all over 100 years old. My kids aren't interested in the history and I tell them that it's all going to the tip when I die. Oh no, Liz, don't do that. Someone will absolutely love it. And another saying, I'm in my 70s, all of my furniture is around 200 years old. When I was young, I wasn't sure how long it would last. Lots of it is solid wood, handmade, and it's gone through all of my 5 kids. So the idea of just being able to pass it down, let me know what you've got, what you've held on to. And if you're going to see Wuthering Heights, which we've been discussing, and we know, right, it's getting media attention and social media coverage all around the world. And as a result, Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, they're doing the rounds and they're doing all of the big TV talk shows. And one of them they did just recently was Graham Norton. Now, they're both, just the backstory for Margot and Jacob, they're both from Queensland. And the conversation on Graham Norton turned very quickly to their accents.
I haven't done really an Aussie accent since I was on Neighbours. And I don't know if I could now because I'd feel so like...
Yeah.
I mean, but this isn't as Queensland as Queensland as like my accent used to be so strong.
Yeah, you have to put
Wait a minute, is this thing true that when you were on Neighbours, they get...
Yes, they got a dialect coach for me.
Oh, I love it.
They got a dialect coach for me because I was too Australian for Neighbours.
I love that. Too Australian for Neighbours. So what is it not only about the Aussie accent, and can you ever be too Australian for Neighbours? And then how hard is it for Australian actors to perfect an English accent? Dr. Melissa Agnew is a voice coach up in Queensland. Melissa, was Margot Robbie ever too Aussie for Neighbours?
No, you can't be too Aussie for Neighbours. Maybe she was doing something with her voice, though, that was a little bit too strident or too nasal. So there's a distinct difference between those other features of the voice and voice production and the accent itself. She's got a lovely sound, though.
Yeah, she really does. Given that you're from Queensland as well,
I'm
Melissa.
I'm from Melbourne.
Oh, you're from Melbourne, but living in Queensland. Oh, okay. So is there a Queensland accent?
This is a subject of great debate, hot debate among linguists and voice people in my fraternity. Look, there are certain trays that we hear a little bit more of here in Queensland than we hear elsewhere. A lot of the things have died out, though, during the time that I've lived here. There used to be, when I first moved here, a lot of the locals would say A at the end or A at the end of practically every utterance. That's gone.
Has it?
I very rarely hear it. I hear it a little bit more further north. But really, the linguists would say that now the difference is more between urban speakers and regional or rural speakers.
I think even that sort of filtered away a little bit. It's interesting, though, I was watching Australian Idol last night. Don't come at me. It's my secret shame. I love Australian Idol. And there was a young a young musician. I think he was somewhere up north. I'm trying to think where he was, but somewhere really remote. And the first thing that I noticed was the speed and how slowly, not in a weird way, but just how slowly he spoke. And it was quite lovely, actually. I thought, wow, you're not rushing everything that you're saying.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, that's a beautiful thing. And it's interesting too, the way that slow, languid pace and rhythm matches the topography. If you look at the landscape out there, it looks like how people sound in that situation. Whereas if you look at the skyline, say, here in Brisbane or in Melbourne, it's much more jaggedy. It's much more busy, lots of ups and downs and surprising shapes.
I've never thought. I will forever look at cities and regional and rural landscapes and listen to how people talk and see how the two are interconnected. That is such a beautiful idea.
You can't unsee it now.
I cannot unsee that in the slightest.
Yeah.
Wow. Melissa, how hard is it for Australian actors to take on an English accent?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I'm in rehearsals at the moment at Griffith University for a play, Nell Gwynn. It's an English play, and it's about one of the first actresses in the Restoration period that made it onto the stage. And she was also a mistress of King Charles II. Anyway, I've got a mixed group of students that I've taught for the last couple of years, voice, speech and dialect. And we are going through that very thing, Rochelle, that you're talking about. So they're all Australian students, all around 20 years old, I suppose, 20, 21 years old, and they're all learning different ways of speaking English for this play. And people learn it in different ways. Some people are more oral. Some people are more kinesthetic. They like to wriggle and move and sway when they're learning a dialect. Some are very technical. They like to see the phonetic symbols for the sound and then watch my mouth make the sound, model the sound for them. So people learn it in different ways. And also I'd have to say some people are not great at doing accent work, I think, or dialect work. It really takes a big leap of courage to relinquish your mouth and all of your suite of sounds, if you like, and replace those and reinstall the dialect and the speech patterns of someone who's quite different from you.
And it's quite a skill. It's not that easy, like, to take on accents. When you see an actor on, whether it be Graham Norton or whatever it may be, and maybe they've been, I don't know, on Stranger Things, for example, and you're like, oh, wow, I didn't actually know you were English because the accent has been so incredibly American. What? How did that happen? So some people are just incredible at it.
Yes, yes. And it's not just about the bunging on of a suite of vowels and consonants and lingo. It's not just the bunging on. You've got to live it and breathe it. as though you or your character has always grown up speaking and learning to speak this way.
Do you like your actors to take it on? Like, do they take the accent home so that, you know, the family members are like, you know, well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be English for the next 6 months?
Many of them do. Many actors do. I'm thinking of other plays that I've worked on at different places and some films as well. Queensland Theatre Company, I can remember a few plays there that I've coached where the actors would go out to dinner, the cast would go out to dinner in the dialect a couple of nights, and they would order everything. They'd talk only in the dialect and they'd live in it.
It's a good way to get to know it and be able to learn to speak it in everyday life. Yeah, I love it. Melissa, thank you. I find it fascinating that, you know, Margot Robbie had to get a voice coach so that she didn't sound too Australian for Neighbours. And now we sort of embrace our Australian accents to a certain degree. Dr. Melissa Agnew, voice coach, who's up in Queensland. Thanks for your time, Melissa.
Thanks, Rochelle.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.